Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of 8 cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
My name is Christopher Carota. I'm a lighting designer. I'm the lighting designer for the band Fish. I also design lighting for professional sports teams, other touring acts, architectural, theater, you name it. It basically began by being in the right place at the right time more than anything else. I was a University of Vermont college student. They were a Burlington, Vermont bar band. I was a fan. We became friends. Some situations occurred where I was taking guitar lessons from Trey at one point. They needed some help carrying equipment. I volunteered, and one thing led to another, and I wound up behind the light board. I'm self-taught. I didn't go to college for it. I didn't major in theatrical lighting design or anything like that, like so many people have. It just organically happened for me. And now I'm in my 33rd year.
My name's Carl Gearhart. There's always those butterflies that you get when you're on stage, but there's a sense of calm. And it's so weird because I hadn't played with them for a while, you know? So, and the song that we played, Party Time, I've never played it. Like he taught it to me backstage, and Fishman's kids were sleeping, so I couldn't even play my horn. I had to put a little mute in, and he wasn't plugged in. And then we went into Paige's dressing room, and he's like, okay, this is how it goes, and this is how it starts, and this is how it ends.
Hi, I'm Elaine Vario. I'm a music lover, like you all. I'm a Deadhead, a.k.a. Fishhead. Those are the best bands around. And I see them all because I'm an usher. So I do NASA Coliseum. I do MSG. We do tennis. Wherever I am needed.
I am Bella Anastasio. I've been seeing fish my entire life since in utero, but I haven't really been seeing fish as a fan and really getting it until 2016 was 2016 summer tour. I started going with friends, and that's when I started really seeing fish.
My name is Brett Vanderbrook, and I'm a bartender at Madison Square Garden.
Hi, my name is Brad Sands, former road manager of the band Fish and manager of Primus and Ween.
Hi, I'm Tom Marshall, and I write lyrics for Fish. Lines like, smegma, dogmatogram, fish market stew? Yep, that's my work. But my job is done weeks or months or years before tour even starts. It takes a lot of kinetically moving parts to put on a fish show, and Fish's road crew are some of the best in the business. While you're still sleeping off the cross-eyed jam from the night before, they're already loading gear into the next venue. So far on season 2 of Undermine, we talked with early adopters about how they first heard about the band. We connected the dots between Fish's rise in popularity and the rise of the internet across college campuses in the mid-90s, and then we hit the road to go see them live. Now that we're pulling into the lot, let's hear from Fish's road crew and learn all about what goes into a Fish load-in. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of Undermine. When you walk into Madison Square Garden, you feel the enormous energy of the building, while also appreciating its place in music history. It's famously the most famous arena in the world. It's the home of the New York Rangers.
54 years of curses are over! No more 1940! Yes, the New York Rangers are going to win!
The home of the New York Knicks. And the home of Fish's New Year's runs. And we're about to go inside its doors while we virtually tour a Fish load-in, just as soon as we hear a few choice words from our sponsors. For music fans and musicians alike, Madison Square Garden is the holy grail of concert venues. The Grateful Dead played the Garden 53 times. With the help of the historic Baker's Dozen in the summer of 2017, Fish has now played the Garden a total of 64 times and counting. They even have their own banner hanging from the rafters, alongside sports championships and other record breakers. Impressive, but sorry guys, Billy Joel still holds the record with more than 100 plays. Although the night is still young. I wanna keep making love to you while the night is still
young. Billy Joel show, you're gonna know the songs. They're almost the same set of songs almost every show. I see him once a month. It's like brushing teeth.
Elaine Vario is an usher at Madison Square Garden.
When you go to a Fish show, it's like a Dead show. They can surprise you. They can bring a guest out you don't expect. They can play a song you never heard them play before. There's that joy of trying to guess what the next song is and then high-fiving the person next to you because it's something that you like. There's something about that that's different than hearing the same set from an album.
Madison Square Garden. That's YEMSG in lizard speak, or just fish speak, whichever makes you more uncomfortable saying. Is a little universe on a large city block, and it takes a small army just to open the doors at such an arena. From the hot dog vendors in the dark.
Hello, hot dog, hot dog.
to the marketing department, to the janitors, ticket takers, sales managers, accountants. And that's just for the building. When a band rolls into town, they bring with them their own traveling road crew. Load-in happens when that crew arrives and moves into the venue for the day, from the back offices to the dressing rooms to the light rig and all the merch stands in between. When you walk into an arena in any town USA, you know you just entered into the Phish experience, as opposed to wandering into just another arena rock concert, and part of that transformation is the recognizable, if always evolving, light rig. The man behind that curtain is Chris Carota, Phish's lighting director for the past 32 years.
I love MSG. I love Bill Graham. I love Hampton. I really liked Atlantic City, the indoor one, even though it's a big, boomy airplane hangar. It just had character. I like the venues that have character. As far as outdoor venues go, Alpine Valley, Blossom, those venues have a ton of character. They're terrible venues to set up in. You know, the roofs are low. It's hard to cram all your stuff in there. We dread going there. But once it's all in, I love those places because they have so much character and so much vibe. I like vibe. I would much prefer to play a dirty old hockey arena that's been around for 80 years than a brand new, sparkling, way too sterile basketball arena that just got built. That's just me.
No, Topher, that's not just you. Fans feel the vibe of a place too, especially when it reverberates with history and time, as evidenced by our collective love for the Hampton Coliseum, for the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium, and of course, for MSG.
Any indoor arena, all of them are terrific. The outdoor amphitheaters, or we call them sheds, the designated area for us to be in, the audio, lighting, sound man, lighting designer area, they're pre-built. Those places are concrete. So some are big and some are small and some are centered and some are off to the left and some are off to the right. And some of them you can barely fit in and you have to Tetris your way in there with the audio gear and the lighting gear, and they're all different. You can't just say, we want to be here and set up in seats that already exist. You have to go to the predetermined area where the venue says you belong.
Venues like MSG are large operations that employ hundreds of people, security, ushers, bartenders, electricians, and it takes all of them to make the show possible. While fans are there to have a good time, the venue staff is there to help make sure the fans have a good time. They're not partying so that you can. But the toughest jobs tend to belong to the band's own road crew, who have to set the stage up the exact same way each night, down to the inch.
Hi, I'm Jefferson Waffle. I was the lighting designer for Moe and Humphreys McGee. For us, it was like, you know, if we'd go into a smaller venue, you know, I'd have to space the lights a lot closer together.
That's what I do. Mm-hmm. A lot of steel, a lot of chain.
You know, they might be 5 feet in all the gaps, 5 feet apart, splitting center 2.5 feet to the left and 2.5 feet to the right. And then you measure 5 feet in between every light. You get to a place like Red Rocks, and now suddenly you've got this giant canvas. And it took me a long time to figure this out. You know, in the early days, I would just, no, this is the measurement. This is my show. And then you get older and you look at the photos and you say, oh man, we look like a small band playing this giant venue. So then you start to space out the lights. So now you might have 8 foot gaps between all the lights. So now your outside lights are closer to the wings. So you fill the space. And that's one of the things that it took me years to realize. It's like, it's okay to have negative space in the rig. All the lights don't need to be super packed tight together.
Chris Carota's light show is such an integral part of the Phish experience that fans, and even the four Phish guys themselves, often think of him as the honorary fifth member of the band, or in acronym form, CK5. It's not just a clever name for stickers or pins in the lot. Occasionally, in the middle of improvised journeys, Carota's lights have been known to jam the band, or sometimes even let them know it's time to bring the jam on home.
And then, of course, there's Andrew Giffen, who sits next to me and programs the show. And we work tireless months putting it all together, technically. You know, without him, it wouldn't be what it is today by a long shot. He has a lot of input, really, really just smart dude. And, you know, it's the two heads are better than one. You know, you think you have all the good ideas till someone says, hey, what about this? And you go, I never would have thought of that. And that's an incredible idea. So he has a lot of those and throws them out on the table too. It's a real symbiotic relationship and it works out really, really well.
The crew is in charge of running the show. One of their main jobs is creating a bubble for the band so that they never need to think about anything other than the music. Backstage, they have a rehearsal room set up if they want to rehearse. They have their favorite food and beverages stocked in their dressing rooms. They know exactly how many cans of exactly what soda or juice will be in their cooler in their respective room, which varies by musician, but not by night. One of them might have 5 Kind bars, another 6 Cliff bars, non-oatmeal, and another fresh veggies and hummus. Fishman gets an oxygen tank.
This will put you right out. There we go.
It's up to them, but it's dialed in and waiting for them at every show before they arrive. And when they arrive is also planned, days in advance.
It's definitely really different now for the kids than it was when my sister and I were little. Back when my sister and I were little, you know, we just were around. It was like what you would kind of expect backstage, and also there were kids there. And we would, when I was younger, around like 11 or 12, we would do family tours. We would do really like touristy things during the days, just like go on fun day trips and, you know, visit like the Mall of America or some national park or something. Now backstage for the kids, it's way different because there's way more kids and it's just like a very family setting backstage now. So they have like scooters, and for really big shows, sometimes they'll have like fun toys and playthings that we like definitely did not have when we were kids. But it was always really fun. I mean, everyone was always really, really sweet and inviting to me, and my sister would help look after us. It's always been just a really fun family event, fish shows, before I started doing it on the other side.
That's Bella Anastasio. And the question was simply, tell us about your summer vacations.
For right now, just like what the whole rock star lifestyle, what people think that looks like, is definitely not at all how any of the band members are existing, especially Dad. You know, he runs off the bus and gets straight to his kale chips and falls asleep. But I think that the members of the band would probably have a different outlook on this than I do, because I still don't really know what the business side is like. I don't really experience it that much, but it's, I guess also that's a lot of the time it is still work. It is still just a job that you have to do. And even though it's really, really fun and really, really great and maybe like the best job ever, it is still work and it's still jobs. And that shows up in a lot of ways. And it's a lot of really hard work. I think Dad wouldn't have so much fun with it if he wasn't just naturally obsessive about music, because all the really hard work comes really naturally for him. But if it didn't, you know, it's not an easy thing to do.
The road crew creates the illusion of routine, even though on tour, it's a different location in a different city and very likely a different state almost every night. When the band members finally make the walk on stage, they could be blindfolded and still be able to fumble their way around, because inch by inch, the stage is almost exactly the same every night, and that doesn't happen by accident. Everything sounds exactly how it should sound, everything looks exactly how it should look. Adjusted for the limitations and quirks of a particular venue, the stage at every Fish show on any given tour will be set up the exact same way every night, so that the only thing that's different is the view from the stage. Well,
and there's always a tweak.
That's Beth from Fish's front office.
Nothing's ever just kind of, okay, set it up static and that's it. That's just not the type of band that Fish is. That's not how it's going to work out. There's going to be, you know, improvement, make it better the whole time. That's just going to be at the top of the list. So even if it looks like maybe everything looks exactly like last night, I guarantee you it is not exactly like last night. A day off is not a day off. A day off is a day to like try to catch some sleep and then spend the entire day working in your hotel room.
I thought that was the worst set we've played in 6 months.
All right. So we know that Fish is an evolving multi-beast. But even the adjustments fall under a well-planned routine with absolutely zero room for uncertainty. The days of wondering where they would crash after the show, or if there's any place still serving food at that hour, are long gone. Nothing has been overlooked or left to chance. Everything has been prearranged and then professionally executed.
Bus call, bus call.
Imagine having to move your entire office every day. Phish does it every stop on every tour and is still able to create a sense of seamless continuity.
Sometimes we drive right from one place to the other and there's nothing in between. If you look at a tour, you can figure it out. But like if the distance is long enough, you're going, we're sometimes not leaving until, you know, 2, 3 for the loadout in the morning. And then you're going straight to the next, driving straight to the next venue. A lot of these venues, of course, that we're playing in are either set up for concerts or they're athletic facilities. So you just go and find an empty dressing room and take a shower and then get to your desk and start working again.
Beth's full name and title, by the way, Beth Montori Rolls, General Manager, Phish Incorporated.
It's very professional backstage at Phish shows. Everyone does their jobs really well. There's a lot of super talented people. You know, the day starts really early and ends really late for a lot of people.
Beth is a fan too, of course. But let this be a cautionary tale for any of you looking to go into business with your favorite band.
I can honestly say that there are definitely shows that I never even see the band. That I'm just backstage the whole time working through the entire show, just trying to keep up with it all.
Load-in is designed to make sure that the rest of the night runs smoothly and according to schedule. And the schedule is real.
I mean, it happens in stages. So the rigging crew, the lighting crew, the audio crew, they start coming in at 6 a.m. Rigging comes in at 6 a.m. Key lighting personnel on the build are on that 6 a.m. call. And then there's a 7 a.m. call. An 8 a.m. call is audio. 9 a.m. is video. 10 a.m. is backline. And staggered in such a way. You know, again, really well thought out. Again, like a choreographed dance. No one's stepping all over each other. Because, you know, think about it. If you got the backline guys there at 8 a.m., and they're still building the stage and building the lighting, those guys they're anxious. They don't want to wait around. They're going to start setting their stuff up at the wrong time and getting in everybody's way or that sort of thing. So trial and error over all these years. And I think all tours are the same in this regard. The production manager types for any act know that you have to stagger it in such a way that it's most productive and people aren't getting in each other's ways and it gets done quicker and, again, safer.
What about Kuroda? He's kind of like a rock star, like a member of the band, right? Does he get to sleep in and stroll on into the venue right before the doors?
Kuroda comes in at 10 a.m. I come in with the backline guys, grab a little breakfast, get out the front of house. Usually my world is being built right around that time, and then we go from there.
Former Umphrey's McGee lighting director Jefferson Waffle was enormously influenced early on by Kuroda's style and approach. Waffle's insight into his own process provides parallel insights into what happens during a Phish load-in.
We would go in at 10 a.m. 10 a.m. means that's when the truck opens and all of the gear comes off the truck. So I would usually go in an hour, maybe 45 minutes before that, and I would start measuring all the points on the stage. But I was very OCD about the measurement of all the lights. So while there would be points being marked on the stage for motors, that might happen from the crew chief or a rigger.
A crew chief is just what it sounds like. A rigger is the skilled tradesperson who physically assembles and raises the light rig and other production elements.
What I would be marking is the spaces between all the lights and making little marks on the stage and bringing in any of the trusses that are up in the air when you walk in and start measuring with a tape measure and marking specifically where all the lights are going to go.
Jefferson Waffle retired from tour life in 2019.
At 2 o'clock, I would come back and I would start putting haze in the air so I could see the beams because that's really important for focusing. You wait until there's a pause in the production because a lot of the crew guys don't want haze while they're miking up guitar amps or whatever. You kind of work together as a team. So like after they're all done wiring the stage, they probably go to lunch at 2, 2:30. On a good day, I would be alone in the theater with a dark stage ready to program for an hour. And I would try to get my programming done by the time the band comes out for sound check, which would typically be around 3:30 or 4.
Hazers are the fog machines you see at Phish and other stage productions. Jam bands love them. They're crucial for the light show, as the mist they create gives the beams sharper definition.
really the first time you relax for me is like after the truck is packed and the day is done and you don't have anything to do until the next morning. So then it winds up being, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning by the time you get to sleep. And then you get 6 hours on an average night and you start all over again the next morning.
First in, last out. That's a common expression for crew guys. They are the first people in the venue and the last to leave. And yet, we'll still be here when you get back from this quick break. Brad Sands was Fish's road manager from 1994 until 2001, and he's a fair-weather Sixers fan to this day.
So bus call is usually 3, 3:30. And that was the one where, you know, it's just a joke that like, if the bus call was at 3, like Paige would be down and Trey would be down pretty much on time. And they'd wait 5 minutes. And they're like, well, no one else is here. We're going to go get coffee. Then Mike would come down after me calling. And he said, well, why did you tell me to come down when they're not even here? I'm like, well, they were here. And then he would walk away. You know, then they would all three come back at the same time. And Fish still wouldn't be here. And then he'd like saunter out of the hotel and everyone would just be like, oh, well, there he is. All right, let's go. You know, like.
Face and face, face and face.
Always kind of sound check around 4, right? That was sort of the sound check time, 4, 4:30. Granted, we didn't have any openers, so we didn't have to like be done at a certain time to set them up before doors. But you know, those guys, like even in the old days, I mean, they always had long sound checks. It was like rare that they would come in and be like hung over from the night before and be like, fuck this, we'll just do one song and be done. Like it's just not in Trey's DNA to be able to do that, you know? I mean, if doors are at 6:30, I mean, you know, the band would never go on at 7:30. So we would always try and wait till the arena was fairly full for a couple of reasons. Obviously, the egress of the fans is not perfect, right? And we don't want to, like, if you go on early and most people aren't in, there's going to be a rush. It creates a sense of, like, there could be a problem. You know, it wasn't always just like we were just backstage fooling around doing nothing. You know, there was an actual reason to what we were doing. You know, sometimes it went on a little too long, but in general, we wanted to get the most people in possible, A, because the energy is better, and B, it's safer.
Trey once said that his only escape from the business of Fish is when he's on stage playing with Fish. As soon as he's off stage, he's back to answering to his tour manager, who these days is the incredible Richard Glasgow. But Brad remembers...
So, well, like, first of all, like, there was always after show food, right? So every night you'd have some food on the bus waiting, like when you finish the gig.
The first thing that happens is immediately, and I'm talking not a second wasted, packing up begin. And a lot of packing up happens backstage behind the scenes before the band is even finished playing, as in getting the road cases organized and ready for the equipment to go in.
Believe me, there's always something going on with production.
You know, there's a lot of people participating in the loadout. The moment those lights come on, at least in my world, we're immediately packing up the lighting consoles, packing up the cases, waiting for some union stagehands to come help us, you know, put the lids on and get them off the riser. And, you know, it's a very, very well-coordinated, organized effort on all parts, not just out where I am, but backstage. It's almost like a dance. It's almost like a choreographed dance. The ultimate goal is to have it go as fast and as seamlessly and as smoothly and as safely as possible, to get that equipment in the trucks in the right way, ready to go. I help a little bit out at front of house where I work with the lighting console, and I'm usually out of there. I say hello to a few people. I walk backstage, I'll grab a There's usually a sandwich or something back there for us to have. You know, these days, right to the bus, right to the shower, right to my pajamas, right to bed. You know, that whole rock and roll fantasy of the backstage party, it may have existed a long time ago, but it doesn't exist anymore. I'm way more interested in getting my sleep and getting my rest on the bus and being ready for the workday the following day.
First in, last out. And while, say, a celebrity lighting designer might get it easier than some on the crew, Kuroda only has a 14-hour show day. His work actually begins months before a tour.
And I would say that I also had a lot of influence early on from the band in the simplest sense. I can just think of a story when they were first writing Punch You in the Eye. You know, they had me into the, you know, in the house in Winooski there. And I came to practice. They invited me to practice and sat me down. And they had some guidelines that they wanted for that particular song. It should be red here. It should be blue there. The change should happen here. It's a complicated song. Pay attention. Learn it. And that was, you know, that was back in like 1989, something like that. And knowing that that was sort of what they were looking for, I think I had presented that already, that I was capable of doing that. And I think they saw that and went, he's capable of doing what we'd like to see. So let's get him in here and explain a little more of what we're looking for. And, you know, those little instructive exercises that I was able to participate with the band definitely helped form the beginning of my quote unquote style, if you could call it that.
Developing his craft in tandem with the band developing theirs, Kuroda's contribution to Phish's live show is inseparable from the Phish experience.
You know, Trey and I have this, we like to joke around, we sort of have this psychic connection. I know when he's going to take it around one more time, or I know when he's going to hit it, but mistakes have been made. You know, there are times when he intentionally takes it around and around and around and around, and everyone's expecting the boom on one, and he doesn't do it. And I just pick up that he just doesn't want to do it there. And sometimes we'll go around like six more times, and the drama that creates, and if I'm connected with him enough, and then on the seventh time, I know he's going to do it. He's not going to take around an eighth time. And you hit that perfectly with them. That is like one of the most satisfying magical moments you can imagine. Hitting the blam on one is one thing, but when he wants to take it further and further and not just making assumptions and really knowing that he's going to do that and being right, guessing correctly. Because if I guess incorrectly, then I don't blam when he does, and that doesn't work. So, but when we're all sort of on the same page, it's a really, really cool thing.
Hence, CK5, the band's fifth member.
Yeah, and I think one of the differences, they're 4 feet away from each other, and I'm 120 feet away from them. I'm sure there are, it's not even I'm sure, I know for a fact, there are all kinds of little facial expressions and signals that they pass back and forth to each other right there that I could never pick up on. I have a different method of trying to stay with them. Trey knows that. Trey will look, and Phish, you know, he's a passionate drummer and he plays with his eyes closed. And if Trey looks at him and his eyes are closed, Trey knows, like, I don't want to catch him off guard and maybe it'll go somewhere else. You know, they're all very in tune with each other in that regard, I think.
It could be something that Kuroda does with the lights that somehow that's different, and everybody realizes it's going on, and then suddenly the whole room gets brought together into this focused ball of energy. And I think that's, you know, that's the one thing that we all keep coming back for, is to have those moments.
Yes, it's those moments that keep all of us coming back for more, again and again. After load-in but before doors, the ushers arrive and take their positions. In the front of house, every section has venue-employed ushers whose job it is to ensure that everyone stays safe, Sometimes they're your best friends. Sometimes they seem like your biggest enemy. But either way, the next time they interfere with your plans because you want to go where you're not supposed to, or because you want to do something that you're not technically allowed to do, just remember, not only are they human, but on another night, they might be the person you're discussing fish with on a Facebook thread.
And there was one guy a couple rows down that kept dancing in my aisle. And the only rule I have is don't dance in my aisle. It's not safe. You could fall. If you fall, it's on me. So he's like, wow, man, you're really bumming me out. You're ruining my experience. I'm like, look, you're making me be a jerk, and I don't want to be a jerk. So, you know, I kept pushing him into his thing and putting the flashlight in his face to bum him out, to make him move. And finally, I walked over to him and I handed him an Uno card. I said, take this card and go sit down. He looks at me, looks at the card, looks at me, looks at the card and goes, oh, wow, man, how did you know my name was Skip? And I said, ushers know everything, so go back to your seat. Yeah, the rest of the night he was in awe of me. So that was my first fish show, and I loved everybody except for the guy that made me be an authority figure and wearing the stupid blazer. Because I always say, people, this isn't the way I dress. When people start getting at me, I'm like, guys, I'm just like you, but they stuck me in a monkey suit.
Brett Vanderbook is a bartender at MSG. He's seen some things in his day, but one thing he never thought he'd live to see was an artist capable of reversing the venue's strict bottle cap policy.
So Madison Square Garden has this policy that you can't keep the top of your water bottle. I guess it's the thing, they don't want people throwing water bottles, and I guess they think it's harder to throw them if the top's not on because then the water comes up. I don't know the exact rule behind it, but it's a big thing there. You can't buy a water bottle with a cap on it. It's not just basketball games. It's every event. It's just a straight across the board. You can't have the bottle cap, except at fish shows. Fish went to the head of security at Madison Square Garden, and they were like, please, please let people have the bottle cap. They went to security and they said, please, for our show, we're like giving you permission. Please let the fans have the caps of the bottles. I'm sure we had like a pre-shift meeting and they were like, hey, just so you know, moving forward at fish shows, when they buy water, just give them the cap. You know, it's been approved by security. It's, you know, it's a request of the band.
The saying goes, safety third, but fish bumped it up two slots.
I mean, the safety protocols involved in that are unbelievable. And that's not, I have nothing to do with those decisions personally. There are teams of professionals who that's what they do for a living on the road with us, making sure that everything is 100% safe the entire time. And I'll tell you this, when we're outside sometimes and we're doing our little cool moves and it's too windy and all of a sudden it looks like these trusses are going to clang into each other or the lights are going to clang into each other, there's somebody backstage with a big red button labeled emergency stop and the lights get put back to flat and I get a call on the radio that says, too windy, can't move them, continue the show, but you're not moving your trusses anymore tonight until the wind dies down or whatever. All based on safety. As fun as it all is, if it's not safe, 100% safe, we're not doing it.
From the time the band members arrive at the venue till the time they're on their way, a photographer is there to capture it all.
The fish experience for me has always been approached as a working photographer.
That's Jay Blakesburg, who is most known for his work in the Grateful Dead space. Blakesburg shoots fish too.
You know, gear, cameras, batteries, film in the old days, you know, cards, that kind of stuff. You know, I don't have a pre-game show. I'm not hanging out in bars, you know, before shows. It depends. And, you know, of course, it was different when I was working for the band. Because when I was working for the band, I was there when they were sound checking, and I was there when they were in their little rehearsal room backstage working out a jam or a song or a guest or whatever it was that they were doing. You know, now when I'm shooting a fish show, I'm typically part of the press corps. You know, I come in, I go into the pit for three songs. You know, usually they let me wander around and maybe shoot some lighting and stuff like that. Might do that for a little bit. because I like shooting Kuroda's lights because they're brilliant, you know, and then I'll go enjoy the show, put my cameras in the office and go and hang out. Or, you know, sometimes I'll go shoot just crowd shots if they're okay with it, you know, and I know these people and they know who I am and people aren't intimidated by me and they're willing to share their space. And I'm just looking for those Kuroda lights to swing out into the audience and light it up at that big moment, that peak moment, and just looking at these people in complete bliss, joy, ecstasy, in complete emotional salvation at that moment. And it happens over and over again. That's why we do this, right? Because that is what is going on then and there. And we are going along for the ride. And the band provides the soundtrack and the energy. And we throw it back, and I just want to photograph that.
That energy that Jay is referring to is a constant thread connecting 1.0 to 4.0 and all the stops in between. But advancements in technology have advanced creative elements of the show, helping ensure that neither the band nor the production gets stuck in a rut. Phish has always been about forward movement, the marriage of technological developments and the constant drive to discover new sonic landscapes and reach for new horizons has not only kept Phish's music interesting as the band reinvents themselves almost every night, but it has also led to the band's ever-evolving light show. If you pull up Google images of Phish's shows past, Gamehenge University graduates would be able to tell you the year the photo was taken, based on some of the musical equipment on stage and on the light rig.
The robotics haven't changed much. The terminology is they pan, they tilt, they do a lot of internal tricks to change colors or put prisms in to break beams up in cool ways, or patterns called gobos where you can make your cone beam or your this or your breakup or your that. It's hard to change that. You know, once it went from park hands to automated lighting fixtures, that's sort of been standard in most of them. They're starting to come up with creative new ways that lights don't just look like a round orifice of light coming out of it. There are now blocks of lights and strips of lights, but the game changer was LED. When it went from incandescent source was Parcan, then it went to arc source and an arc bulb source for many, many years, and then LED came in. What's going on right now is, you know, everyone knows LED consumes a lot less power. It's way more efficient. But at first, they couldn't get them bright. Now the technology has advanced in the last decade or so, where now the LED lighting fixtures are just as bright, if not brighter, than the arc source lighting fixtures. And that's the game changer. And, you know, LED has its pros and its cons. It's very difficult to make an LED light yellow. The LED, the light emitting diode, just doesn't want to be yellow. There's all these crazy mixing systems to try to achieve certain colors that are organically easier with the arc source light. But again, the technology is advancing to the point where the manufacturers and genius lighting designers are figuring this stuff out and putting out better and better products every year.
Don't shine that thing in my face, man.
We all got together, band, myself, talked to other designers and collaborated with other people and wanted to be different. And we came up with the video wall that opened and closed. And it was a big moving piece that opened and closed. And, you know, everyone liked it. We liked it. We worked on it forever, creating content. The whole idea was video that doesn't look like video. We wanted it to be organic because it's Phish. And it turned out the way it turned out and everyone's seen it. And after the 1 year we used it, we all kind of decided that we were done with it. Like, okay, now what? Through that experience, I had an idea in my head. Also seeing shows like Red Hot Chili Peppers, where they have the 1,000 balls going up and down, the little balls moving. I just said to myself, why does it have to be little balls? Why do you have to move 10-pound objects like that? Why can't we move 2-ton objects like that? And the band came to me and said, we've offered our ideas and we've sort of pushed you in other directions. And finally, this time, we're just going to ask you flat out, what do you want to do? And I went, I want to have a bunch of trusses and move them up and down and create different shapes with them throughout the night and move them all night long. And that's what I want to do. And they went, okay. And that sounds simple. And then that led to about 400 million headaches to figure out how to make that work, how to make the lights stay on the band members while the trusses are moving, which is this basically NASA-style XYZ coordinate tracking that we had to implement into it was a nightmare because it didn't work. And we had to figure out a way to make it work. And it took months and months, but it works. If I take that horizontal truss and point that light at Trey, and then I move that truss vertical, that light will stay on Trey. That light will not point at the sidewall. It's a lot of really complicated math going on within the light and within the lighting console. It was a headache, but we figured it out. It's basically trigonometry.
So we've got lights, we've got cameras. Before we have action, we have one other group of people we need to check in on, just after this very quick break. Told you it would be quick, and I even remembered who we needed to check in on. The tapers. Every one of us owes the tapers a huge debt of appreciation because if it wasn't for them, the band would never be where they are today. These days, it's easy to forget that because we have live Phish. Therefore, Phish's taper section isn't quite what it used to be, but if it hadn't once been there, we might not be here.
I mean, initially, it's important to remember that there wasn't a taper section. When you were out there taping shows in late 80s, early 90s, everything was localized.
That's Dean Budnick.
You'd go to a show, you'd see your local community members, and it wasn't all that different from seeing them at some other show earlier or later in the week. It was simply a common interest that all of you shared, and it was fun. These people were your friends.
You might recognize Dean's voice from the podcast Long May They Run, which dedicated their entire first season to just one band, Phish. Dean also published one of the very first books about Phish in 1996, The Phishing Manual. And he's now editor-in-chief of Relics magazine. Before any of that, Dean was a taper in the audience at Phish shows.
Things changed a bit in the fall of 1993 when Phish created an officially sanctioned taper section. The band announced that while mail-order ticketing was still on the horizon, that for the final four shows of the year, tapers would have the option of purchasing special tickets that were set up behind the soundboard so they could all collectively mass and record the shows. Folks were excited about this, even if they weren't tapered, because it meant that mail order ticketing was looming. People always respected the individuals with the best gear, in particular, the most sensitive high-end mics. So the people who had the sweet mics were always at the top of the food chain, and most of them, by the way, were really respectful of everyone else and were conscious of offering patches to folks behind them. I did not have high-end mics, although I had a decent DAT, so I was someone who would walk into a show and maybe I'd see people I knew, maybe I introduced myself to someone else with the goal of being able ultimately to receive a patch from whomever was at the top of the food chain. Well, you could ask for a patch from someone who had a better set of mics than you did, but you had to wait until the mics were set up. Then, assuming the band wasn't going to hit for another 15, 20 minutes or the like, you could put in your request. And usually what you did is you approached someone else who also was receiving a patch, and then ultimately went ahead and asked the person at the front of the line, because it was a daisy chain. And the only other rule there is that everyone who was running DATs would be ahead of individuals who were running analog decks, because if you were running analog decks, whoever was behind you would lose their signal when you flipped the tape. I would say that particularly, again, post-December 1993, really, it wasn't all that hierarchical because people who were down in the taping section were roughly the same age and I think had a lot of the same experiences that led them to that particular place, and they were respectful of one another. I went down into the dead taper section on a couple of occasions And it was difficult to find people who would engage with me. And I understand that. No disrespect to any of them. That had been going on for a long period of time. And people weren't all that keen on giving a patch to some punk kid, which, again, altogether cool by me.
In the early and mid-90s, you likely discovered Phish by some kid down the hall in your dorm who had live tapes, or as we detailed in the season 2 opener of Undermine, maybe you first heard Phish as filler on a live Dead tape. All thanks to the tapers. At that point, you were likely to get on the then-emerging internet down at your college's computer lab to try to learn more about them and to connect with other fans. Remember? Good, because there will be a pop quiz. But first, let's hear from Dean about how the tapers section was kind of like Facebook before Facebook when it came to gleaning information about the band.
The taper section was a real community gathering place that almost functioned as an internet bulletin board circa 1993. At that time, I was on recmusic.fish, but not everyone was, so people would gravitate to the taper section because that was a place where they could gather information. And the people in the taper section often shared intel with one another at a time when a lot of that was much, much harder to come by. The other thing I remember from this time is a fair number of Phish tapers sort of had a messianic zeal about what they were doing. They were so passionate about this band, which was still unknown to so many folks, that they wanted to spread the good word, particularly at a time when certain people be dismissive about what the band was doing. So they'd proselytize, often by offering up shows online for blanks and postage.
Blanks and postage, also known as a B&P deal, meant that you could put blank cassette tapes in the mail along with prepaid return postage, and the stranger you mailed them to would dub their own copy of the show you wanted using two tape decks.
You'd set something up, particularly on Rec Music Fish, and say, if you want to get a copy of the show, send me blank tapes, send me return postage. I will then copy the show, dub it, and send it to you. I know I did that myself on a few occasions. In particular, I can distinctly recall flying down to Texas for the 3-show run in May 1994 and coming back from one show in particular that blew my mind, which was at the Bomb Factory on 5/7/94. So excited about it that I just wanted to get that out there in the world to let people know that Phish had done something altogether new with this second set that was a fully segued sequence that came out of Tweezer. At the time, it was just remarkable. So I went online myself to Rec Music Phish and offered up this to anyone else in the community. And I felt great about it. I think, again, there were a lot of people like me who were online and did tape shows and really wanted to spread the word. The thing about the taper section, it was an easy way to find other people who enjoyed the music on a particular level, who had seen the band so many times and had listened to the band so many times because they had this tape collection, that they could talk about it from a certain perspective that other tapers or other rabid fans of the band could really appreciate. And it also was easy to carry on a conversation with individuals in this section at the right time, not during a show, not during setup, usually not during the moment of breaking down gear. Again, set break was an ideal moment, or early on, well before the show started, where you really could talk about what was going on and how Phish was evolving. And for those of us who were out there taping, that was a lot of fun to be able to have those kinds of conversations.
Of course, there are a lot of us who still have a lot of fun having those conversations with like-minded fans, but we do it on the internet, using our phones, or by tuning into a podcast. Does the internet mirror real life, or does real life just reflect Fantasy Tour? Wait, let's hear from Brad. Different Brad.
I'm Brad Serling, founder and CEO of Nugs.net. Nugs.net is a site that I started in the 90s to share my Phish and Dead tapes which then evolved into livefish.com as our first commercial enterprise. That was a partnership with Fish that we did in 2002 when the band came back New Year's at MSG. I know there was a lot of backlash when we announced Live Fish. It was like, oh man, but which was totally unfounded because it's not like we said you can't tape Fish anymore. That was a very important part. And when I first went to the barn to meet with the band about doing Live Fish, the very first thing Trey said to me was like, I want you to keep Nugsnet free. We want all the free stuff on Nugsnet to still exist. You know, I don't want any fan to think that Fish co-opted what you were doing out of love and turned it into a business. So that always stuck in my head, which was actually why for years I created unnecessary confusion and had livefish.com and livedownloads.com that was powered by Nugsnet, but then Nugs.net stayed a free tape trading site. And it created a lot of confusion because the company was called Nugsnet, but there was livedownloads.com. And, you know, for bands like The Biscuits and String Cheese and Humphreys and Panic, you know, everything was on livedownloads.com, but Nugs.net was still a free site. It was just kind of weird. And then it wasn't until we actually launched Nugsnet as a streaming service in 2015 that we said, okay, Nugs.net is now the company and the site and the service and the store. And then we still have Live Fish kind of sitting over here in a parallel universe.
If I'd be critical about anything relative to the taper section, to me, it's that at times those were the individuals who would sort of throw down their knowledge or use it as cultural capital and try to define themselves against everyone else in the venue or other people who were coming up to them and just wanted to say hey or talk about the band. And I'm never a fan of that. I mean, frankly, that's in part what led me to write the Fishing Manual, which I started in 1995. It always sort of infuriated me when people were courting information or being dismissive of other individuals because they didn't have these particular little crucial bits of intel that, quite frankly, they couldn't be expected to have. That's something that sort of continues to animate me here and there, somewhat to this end, and maybe this is a crusade of mine. I don't know how many Fish shows I've attended. I don't like having a number. I don't like throwing down that particular way. It's fine for people who do, but I honestly believe that someone can make a contribution to any conversation and that their observations are altogether valid, whether this is their first show or whether it's their 400th.
One guy who probably knew more about Fish in the 90s than just about anyone was Brad Sands. And he wasn't talking. Not then, anyway. As an employee of the band, he was required to keep mum on anything that wasn't public information, and even a few items that probably were. Brad got the gig as Fish's tour manager the same way that many people get their first job, being in the right place at the right time, and then brown nosing.
So then we went to this place in New Mexico. We were there early because we were just, what the fuck are we going to do? We're in Santa Fe. Or, you know, the gig was right there. And then, like, they had nobody showed up to help them load in their gear. So me and my friend Dustin, we were like, do you guys want help? And they're like, sure. And we just thought it was cool. Like, we're pushing the gear and all that, you know. Andrew Fishbeck, who was the tour manager at the time, was saying, he said, hey, do you want to sell merch tonight? And I was like, sure, why not? Cool, you know. Like, and so I'm selling the merch. And he's like, hey, we're going to be hiring somebody next year. Would you be interested in the job? And I'm like, inside my head, I'm thinking, fuck yeah, this is like, of course, you know? So we canceled our trip to go see the Dead. We went to the rest of the shows on the tour. I bought tickets for every show and I worked the whole time. And yeah, basically brown nosed my way right in there. The reason I got the job mainly is because Kuroda was too lazy to drive too lazy to tear down the lights and couldn't drive the truck. Like, they needed like an extra guy. So I owe it to Chris, really, in the sense of like, so we were playing like Fort Collins, I think, or something. This is about a week after I'd been, you know, working for him. And Chris is like, hey, do you think you know how to tear down the lights by yourself? Like, kind of test me. I'm like, yeah, definitely, sure. He's like, all right, see you later, and he just took off.
Brad was tour manager in 1994 when the Giant Country Horns made a surprise appearance at the band's Beacon Theater gig on April 15th. but he must have been busy that night because trumpet player Carl Gears Gearhart was locked out of the venue.
I remember we played at the Beacon Theater right after Hoist came out, and we played the Flynn Theater in Burlington, and it was a benefit show. So it was a couple of years past the Giant Country Horns tour, but we had a lot of, they called the Giant Country Horns. We had the original guys and a few other guys that came on stage to do that. So we played that gig. I was living in New Orleans, and I got a call from their management saying, hey, can you come up to New York and play the Beacon Theater? We're going to kind of do a surprise. The Horns weren't going to be on the bill. They flew me up from New Orleans, and there was a sound check that I had to get to because we were going to do all the new stuff, Wolfman's Brother, Julius, right? We had to rehearse that stuff. So everybody else was driving down from Vermont or, you know, and I had to fly in. I just remember getting to JFK or like where, I forget where I came into, and I was going to be late. And I told the cabbie, I said, please get me to the Beacon Theater as fast as you can. Flying through New York City to get me to the Beacon Theater, he let me off in front. There was mobs of people waiting outside of the venue. This is in the middle of the afternoon. And I just had like a little suitcase and my trumpet. And I tried to get in the front door of the venue and they wouldn't let me in. I'm like, hey, I'm going to be playing. And I'm not supposed to say anything, but somebody recognized me, right? Uh-huh. And they're like, hey, Gears, you're going to, wait a second. And so I don't know if word got around, but anyway, they told me to go around backstage. So I went all the way around the venue and they let me in the backstage. And I literally got there with 1 minute before sound check to do the rehearsals.
One word that gets used a lot on both sides of the house with Phish is family. You have your Phish family, and I have mine, and together we have a community. For the members of the band, they have their Phish family, the other band members, the crew, the organization, and then they have their actual family, wives, sons, daughters, and these days the two families kind of form a Venn diagram. Everything is overlapping. Isabella Anastasio's family tours involved following Trey around, but not in the way that yours do.
Like when I was a little kid, I didn't care about the music at all. I did not get it. I was not interested. But the lights, when you're a little kid, you can get that. That and the glow sticks. Like I was super into the glow sticks as a little kid. I think just like hanging out, just the four of us, me, mom, dad, and Eliza on the bus, we would always have like a TV show that we would watch just like mad hours of. And for this one summer, or maybe it was two summers actually, it was like the original Star Trek series. We would watch so much of it in between shows and then like all kind of just like fall asleep. And the menu for the DVD, like it would, you know, loop after the DVD finished playing, it would like loop back to the like menu screen. And there's these like sounds that it would play that were just like beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, 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 just like Star Trek noises. And like, I still remember really clearly like sleeping on the bus and just hearing that in the background and like the always pretending that the like door on the bus was like the Star Trek spaceship door, being like pretending this poor bus was like the Star Trek spaceship and just, it's like, oh, we're on the USS Enterprise. Yeah, I think it's really magical how this tradition has lasted and how people who started the tradition are welcoming in us youngsters with welcoming arms and teaching us the ropes, and how it's just this shared experience that people from all over the place and whenever the place, and it's, yeah, I think it's really special and great.
Despite all their magic, Phish shows don't just happen with the wave of a wand. They happen only after months of planning and a full day of labor-intensive work inside the venue. Hours of work for your 4 hours of fun. You don't just have to count them, just enjoy them one by one. And while all of that is happening, you've got your mind on one thing: getting to the lot in time to enjoy yourself before going into the show. We'll pull into the lot and go deep into Shakedown next time on Undermine. Undermine is brought to you by Osiris Media, the leading music storyteller. Executive producers are Tom Marshall, RJB, Brian Brinkman, and Matt Dwyer. Written by Benji Eisen. Produced and edited by Brian Brinkman. Mixed and mastered by Matt Dwyer. Produced by David Goldstein, Jonathan Hart, Brad Tenbrook, and Don Jenkins. Production assistance and writing by Noah Eckstein and Julia Schuster. Social media by Nick Sejas. Original music by Amar Sastry. Show art by Mark Dowd. Thank you to all our interviewees. We'll see you next week. Next time on Undermine.
Yeah, it really depended. When I was a little kid, it would make me really sad. I would definitely freak out when I knew that Dad was leaving for a long time. It totally stressed me out. I would have like nightmares if something would happen to him on tour. One time while he was on a longer tour and he wasn't going to be back for a while, I had a nightmare that he had died on tour, and my mom held auditions for my new dad. And she hired Spider-Man to be my new dad. And for years, I hated Spider-Man because I was like, you're not my dad. Can you come for my breath? Take a look overhead. Hey there, there goes the Spider-Man.
In the chair. Osiris.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.